Hello and welcome to the next episode of Research VR, where we try to dig deeper inside the current insights of virtual reality and try to map it upon the research that is happening around virtual reality and has happened before. Today we have a special guest, Nima Ashkari, and as usual, our lovely co-host Azad Balabanian. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, hi, Peter.
How are you doing, guys?
I'm really excited to do this. VR is hot. Drones are hot. Let's combine them. It's going to boil.
Exactly. Today's topic is on drones and virtual reality. And you might ask yourself, okay, those flying machines, what exactly have to do with virtual reality? And we will actually live today this mystery. So maybe you could start off and introduce yourself, Nima. Who are you? What have you been doing?
Yeah, I'm sitting with Petr here. I just came back to Osnabrück, where we study cognitive science. I took about half a year time off from university to start my startup in Berlin, and just came out of my own personal interest and research. I was working on all kinds of drones, and then at the end, I went through an accelerator program. It looked like a business. We got angel financing and then started a company back in 2015. What we did was very boring, actually, industrial drones to make them really autonomous. So the science part of it is interesting. And it gave me a broad knowledge about the drone space and the technology behind it. We didn't really have much to do with virtual reality, but being in Berlin, such a creative place, people come to us and we happen to have geniuses who did all kinds of crazy things with VR, drones, FPV racing, things that we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. I'm really
amazing.
Looking forward to having this conversation and sharing whatever I know.
So last time we actually spoke about medical usage in virtual reality. That was very industrial. So I think that our audience, and we hope that our audience is the same opinion as we have, is actually interested in industrial stuff. And if your audience is listening there and you want to comment on something, feel free to email us. Once again, we are reliable, really reliable on your feedback, and we don't have much yet. However, our audience numbers are really rising. Now coming more towards the drones. So what exactly have your drones have been doing? You have done something with SLAM, right?
Yeah. So the big problem that we had to solve was mapping the environment around the drone. Usually the drones that you see on the market, they just rely on GPS. So you give them some kind of path and then they fly. It's very useful when you don't have any kind of obstacle and it's outdoor. But if you have complex structures, you cannot rely on external positioning, basically GPS. So the problem that we addressed was how do we map the environment in real time and localize the drone, and that you call a SLAM. As far as I know, it's also a very useful technique for virtual reality and
exactly.
AR. AR is, in fact, much closer to autonomy for drones than virtual reality because you have this perception part. Differences with our drones in industrial scenarios, you have tens, hundreds of meters of range that you need to cover with cameras or LiDARs. But with AR, it's kind of short range.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of overlap. And the goal is to have a drone that doesn't need to get points to navigate. It gets an object, recognizes the object based on a 3D model, and then takes care of everything else. So obstacle avoidance is a part of it, mapping is a part of it, and it's basically a conjunction of having onboard autonomy with the ability to recognize objects in very large scale.
Mm-hmm. And we have actually spoken before on one of the podcasts about the new HTC Vive camera that, apparently not only drones need to avoid obstacles, but also humans. In a certain way, you don't want to bump into the table when you have the...
I mean, how's your drones kind of mapping out the outside world around it? And what kind of, what are you using? LiDAR? Are you using cameras? Are you doing edge detection?
It's basically, it's mainly based on LiDAR. So there's this company called Velodyne. They used to supply Google cars with those bumpy things that they have on top. Mm-hmm. And they're the leading manufacturer of 3D LiDARs. And this gives you a lot of things for free that you don't get if you just use cameras and you want to do visual odometry just based on vision. So LiDARs are very reliable. They're proven technology. They're industrial grade. And the first thing that you get almost for free is obstacle detection, so you don't crash, and that's very important. And then the second part is it gives you a very nice map. You still need to apply some algorithms, and our magic sauce is basically to do this in real time. There are companies who do post-processed maps, but to be able to do this very efficiently on something like one core of a Raspberry Pi, in real time, that's something that needs some time and work. So when you have the map, then the next step is to know where you are and where is your target, and then the rest is I don't say trivial, but you have, you know, almost 90% of the problem solved.
Do you think it's actually possible to have, let's say, in your smartphone or some kind of VR goggles inbuilt some nice SLAM hardware that, you know, detects the room around you in real time and is actually being capable of detecting it?
I think there's a lot going on. The two major developments are Project Tango from Google. Mm-hmm. That one was, in fact, already put on a couple of drones, one in, I think, Munich, and our one, University of Pennsylvania, Grasp Lab. So they put these... it's like a phone. We actually had it for a hackathon. It's very nice. You have a tiny Kinect inside it.
Is it a phone or is it the tablet that they were doing the project?
They have both.
Developer.
I think for the drone, it makes sense to have the phone. It's lighter.
Right. I didn't know they had the phone yet because they're releasing one with
in
Lenovo.
The second episode about it. You remember when they had this confusion about this Intel phone that supports both Tango and RealSense?
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's this one.
Yeah, and another one is RealSense. So I was actually lucky to get RealSense quite early in end of 2013, I guess.
You applied, right?
Yeah, we were a finalist for Intel Perceptual Computing Challenge. So I think it has changed a lot. Now they rely more on a stereo than this kind of projection of IR patterns. But these are the two giants, titans of the industry who are working on perception. One of them, Project Tango, another one, RealSense. Of course, there are other companies who just have, you know, stereo or monocular cameras. But you definitely have a lot of space for, you know, transfer from robotics to VR, AR, and the opposite.
Amazing.
The computer vision, I mean, is so transferable from everything, from, you know, just normal AI to VR to
self-driving
robots.
Cars.
And that's exactly. So this overlap is basically this technology growing and it's spreading out to all these different offshoots. So that's where, you know, all of these things can come in together.
Definitely.
I mean, you're talking about inside out positional tracking, right? From what we've been hearing from John Carmack. John Carmack.
Exactly.
He himself is working on, said, inside out positional tracking. And I'm guessing they're using two cameras. Like, that's probably the simplest way. And that's what is rumored for the Galaxy S7. And I believe the Note 6 is that it's going to have like two cameras doing some kind of real time positional tracking. I mean, how do you see? Does advancements in the VR industry, do you see that applying into the drones like right out of the box, or is the drone kind of positional tracking a lot better already and it's more of like the VR companies are catching up to drones now? What do you think?
Maybe I'm biased, but I think the drone research community, or in general robotics, aerial robotics, they're ahead of the VR industry. Maybe VR, the research, as far as I know, has been going on like robotics for quite some time. But the, you know, mainstream real world application of field robots happened earlier than VR. VR is, you know, now being commercialized, but robots were already on the field for more than 10, 15 years. So there's a little bit more experience there, but there's the same tendency to miniaturize everything, simplify, make algorithms more efficient to run on you know, mobile processors. There's a lot which is in common. And most probably in like 2-3 years, not even 5 years, You're going to see exactly the same sensor, most probably from Intel, on a drone, consumer drone, smaller drones, not large military or industrial. And then the same thing on a phone or laptop or tablet or goggle. So there's a lot in common, and it's great for, you know, both industries. I think VR is going to be a larger market in the beginning, and then maybe the next 5 years, because you don't need to get FAA permission to wear your VR goggle. Yeah. But at the end, we'll see which industry is going to eat up the other one.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know if that is true. If VR is going to be bigger than drones. I mean, even initially, sorry if you guys are hearing construction noise outside. They're literally right outside my window for some reason.
Probably filter it out with aggressive filters.
I hope so. Nima, I mean, because drones are going to be used for so many things, and from industrial to enterprise to just, personal use, I mean, I think VR obviously is going to fit into all three categories there, but like having the ability to transport something with drones, I think is definitely going to take things to another level in terms of like probably 30-40 years from now. Like, my vision is that I'm going to look up in the sky and I'm going to see kind of drones going in grid like shapes, kind of like Coruscant in Star Wars, if you know what I'm talking about. I absolutely think there's just going to be things flying around, and who knows, I guess we'll probably all be wearing augmented reality glasses instead of just sitting in a room doing VR, but
they will all be glass holes.
Glass, yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. AR and drones, that's something that I hope to do my thesis on, to combine kind of gaze tracking and augmented reality goggles with a new method of interaction for drones. That maybe we could talk about in the future part.
Absolutely.
But it might be interesting for our audience if they get some kind of intro to the whole drone space. I assume everybody knows quite a lot about drones, but just wanted to give you some kind of overview. You could actually divide the whole thing, besides the military applications, into three segments. You have these, tiny drones that are even sub-professional. You use them as toys almost, or it's mostly for entertainment. They're costing up to 1,200 under 1K. And then you have another segment of drones that are being used for professional applications, filming, so they can carry, larger cameras. DJI is in that space playing. And then you have these very expensive, compared to the consumer drones, they cost like 20K, 30K, 50K, up to whatever, $500,000, that they're used for industrial applications, for search and rescue, for longer endurance missions. And what is probably more interesting for the audience of your talk show or for your podcast is the first one and second one. So you have these tiny drones that are becoming more capable, like Parrot is playing in this space, and they're kind of innovating all the time. They have the Bepop too now. And then for the more professional filming, you have DJI, which is leading the market virtually. They have, I think, over 95% market share at the moment. And what might be really interesting is you have these, surround 360 experiences in virtual reality. They're now mostly virtual, really, so they're computer generated, but with drones you could mount 360 cameras on them and then go wherever you want, capture and very large environment, and then either map the texture to some kind of computer generated model or just use this 360 footage. This is really exciting. I'm not actually sure if 360 video is the same thing as VR, probably not. Mm-hmm. But what I was told by Azad was, if you have head tracking, it kind of counts as VR. So I take his word. And
he is our expert.
Yeah.
I just said it starts to kind of bleed into the VR territory when you have head tracking. But yes, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So then, you know, if you look at what is already out there, I cannot think of a VR drone. There was an AR drone, which kind of worked, and but didn't become a serious platform that Pirate hoped. Mostly researcher used
it. You know the name?
AR Drone 1 and AR Drone 2 from Parrot. So it was a really great platform for researchers to do all kinds of vision and robotics things on top.
So how did that work, or what did you use as, what was the AR part of it? Like, did you use a phone, or was it a head-mounted display?
I think back then the head-mounted displays were not hot, so that you just had your iPad. And the way it worked was you put some kind of AR tag on another drone or something in the environment that the onboard processor of the drone can recognize, and then it augments something on top. So you could have like drone fights in mid-air, and you could see a missile literally going and hitting the other drone. And it would kind of shut down. That was really cool, and it was the first smart drone. So until then you just had RC toys, so it was just a remote control thing, but this one from Parrot actually put some computational power on board, and then it gave birth to a whole new kind of generation of more intelligent drones. What they have now is kind of targeted at entertainment and just, you know, filming, more in the direction of DJI, which is the largest company. And it's quite exciting because it has a fisheye lens. It's very wide angle.
It's a Bebop, right?
Yeah, Bebop and Bebop 2. So you can connect all kinds of these VR goggles with head tracking. And then it has some kind of virtual gimbal. It does a digital video stabilization. So you can look around despite the drone being still. Not moving. So that's really exciting.
That's for motion sickness purposes, I'm guessing. Is not just for recording, but I'm guessing if it's shaking around and moving, then it might definitely would make you motion sick.
Definitely, it must be some stabilization to people don't get sick.
And so this is one approach that you have a kind of fish eye or a half a spherical lens that you don't need any kind of gimbal. But there is another approach that people already, I think from two years ago, they started building these 360 rigs with a lot of GoPros, 4, 6, 8, 9, whatever. You can 3D print something and then just shoot 360 video, and then they use post-processing to match it, to stitch it together. This is one way, but now you're seeing more and more consumer 360 cameras that you can mount on drones. What I personally would love to see is a real VR drone. So a drone which is purpose-built for capturing 360 content. Maybe that's what GoPro is working on. I don't know if you've heard, but GoPro even acquired the Swiss company Skybotics, and they're working on drones. They really need this kind of innovation. GoPro's stock market.
Yes.
Yeah, they really went down like 80% in 1 year. So they need this kind of innovation.
Nima, did you see the video they put out like I think a month or two ago that was from their drone footage? Have you had?
Yeah, I've seen it, but it had nothing about it being 360. So probably that's not going
right. It was just extremely stable is what I remember seeing from the video. And the video quality was like quite superb. I was talking to a drone friend of mine who was very impressed, but they kind of have to be going down the 360 round. If Nokia and Nikon and like literally every other camera manufacturer is doing it just for the hell of it, even Nokia with the Ozo, actually, I think I saw a very expensive drone with like 10 different rotors was flying an Ozo. Do you know the Ozo?
Yeah.
I think it's like $20,000, Peter, is it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
How heavy is it?
It is not very heavy, but the cartridges
it's this
are...
Big.
Yeah, exactly. It's not very huge, but the cartridges that you put in that have an SSD
inside,
right, storage stuff are super expensive too. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about cameras. I mean, you did some heavy research on 360 and 180 cameras. You have even one yourself from Kodak.
Yeah, more than one. So the Kodak has
also one.
Something like SP360. It's very fun. But I think we are going to see more companies coming out with consumer 360 cameras. There are like 360 Fly, there's Kodak, there's Theta, all of them. As I said, I'm a drone guy, and I hope to see somebody really tightly integrate these cameras with a drone. Because the problem is you have these rotors that occlude the area around the props, the propellers, and that doesn't give you a clean output. So one way to do it is to have a really, really complex setup that I saw 1 or 2 months ago in Berlin. You put something like a spider around the drone.
Whoa.
With mechanical stabilization and like 6 cameras all around the vehicle. That makes it really heavy and huge. Mm-hmm. The drone that I saw was like more than 2 meters wide.
Yes.
And then I think you don't have enough overlap in that kind of setup. The distance between the lenses are very huge. So what you need is some kind of spherical shaped drone. That's really hard to solve the problem, the mechanical propulsion problem.
Yeah,
but
right.
That's what you need. Like the Prometheus, I don't know if you remember the movie, they had these tiny balls that they threw in the air and they just go around and scan everything. So that's kind of the
right
dream.
There is actually such a camera, right? That you throw in the air?
But it doesn't stay. It's Panono. It has, I don't know, like over 100 megapixel resolution. It has a lot of tiny cameras, and then you throw it in the air for a moment. It detects the highest point and then captures the thing, but falls down.
Didn't you talk to them, I think, at some point?
But it's not really drone friendly. That thing is a little bit big, and it doesn't capture video. It's as far as I know, it's just for photos.
Mm. Okay.
So what's it called?
Panono.
Panono. It's a Berlin-based hardware startup.
Apparently it's in my history. Apparently I've been on their website.
Yeah, it's like a bowl with a lot of cameras. You throw it up, and the moment it's kind of stabilized in the air before it falls down, it makes a lot of photos
and
stitches them together. So is there like any other special cameras, or maybe the Samsung one?
The one from Samsung is not very drone friendly. So I think they have something called Project Beyond.
Yeah. Have you played with that?
No, I don't think anybody has it's not commercially available. But another area that you could have drones plus VR, or at least the kind of experience of having head-mounted displays, is drone racing. And that's a very recent and hot topic.
Before we go into drone racing, which is very interesting and actually more tightly connected to VR and augmented reality, maybe you could actually tell us what are the limitations currently available drones have on the market, let's say in terms of weights they can carry and also the fly time. Because if you imagine, a camera will always have some weight, and if you put a rig of GoPros, even when the rig is not very heavy, you know, it adds more friction to the air and other things, so the drone has, you know, to fight it. So what's actually possible right now with, let's say, high level consumer, expensive but still consumer drone?
Well, really everything is possible, and you can have a custom built drone that lifts a human being, or 50 kilogram, 20 kilogram. You don't have any limit there, but the more accessible, like lower range drones that people can buy, like the DJI Phantom or Inspire, they can't carry much more weight than the one camera that they have. So it's like one GoPro. It would fly like, I don't know, 3 or 5 minutes if you put a complete 360 rig.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a very good idea. What you could do is get one of these smaller wide-angle lens 360 cameras, like the Ricoh Theta. Yeah. That one, I think I saw somebody put it on a drone. You still need to stabilize it. That's not very standardized yet, but that's a solution that you can have. So to buy these things,
that's probably the simplest way, right? Is having two 180 cameras, like a Theta, like the Nikon one that's coming out, and I mean, they're all going to be that GoPro size. It's 180 on the front, 180 in the back, and it looks like a cube. And I've seen a couple of them already. So, I mean, it's the in terms of like resolution, it's definitely not that good. Like the Ricoh Theta, it's like, ugh. I've seen, you try to watch video from it and it's not that good, you know, which is the reason why I didn't buy it. But so can you see, I mean, 360 live video with head tracking kind of being a thing instead of it being on a gimbal that you're moving around? I mean, that's what you can do with the DJI Phantom right now with... I think I saw it with the Avagant Glyph.
Exactly.
It was the head track.
Yes.
Head tracking. I think, can you talk more about that?
Yeah, what we did ourselves with our drone was just for fun. We put Kodak SP360. So if you put it under the drone, you can see more than 180 degrees around it. More than that is not really useful because you have the propellers and there's the occlusion, it becomes ugly. As you said, there's this issue with mechanical gimbals that you only see one viewpoint. If you have multiple viewers at the same time, they cannot look in different directions. Maybe they want to do that. So it's kind of a, at the moment, you can have a kind of a head-mounted display experience from drones in real time with good quality, like Full HD in near real time. But there's a pilot and a co-pilot who are acting like a director, and they show you what they want you to see. It's useful for like tourism. If you go to, I don't know, Paris doesn't allow people, but it would be nice, let's say another city, Berlin, you go to Berlin, you want to have some kind of bird's eye view of the city, the historical sites, and then you put this goggle on your face and then just go into an aerial trip of the whole city. But it would be nice to have 360 with virtual gimbaling, so anybody could look wherever they want. That is not yet figured out completely. So you have like maybe one issue is the bandwidth that you need for transmitting really good quality live video.
And latency, obviously.
Yeah. Latency is fine if it's not for, I don't know, piloting or inspection or industry. If it's just for tourism, they don't see the drone exactly where it is, so they don't get that kind of motion sickness that in the in-synchrony between the movement of the camera and then. So it's fine if it's not real time completely, but it just needs a lot of bandwidth, and it's not like a consumer solution yet. That would be a nice innovation, and all the pieces exist, but it's not a complete experience yet.
Absolutely. I mean, this is kind of starting to kind of bleed into telepresence, if you'd agree. I mean, in terms of like, they have these telepresence robots that you can go move around with just your computer and there you are. What about like adding actual, I know obviously it's adding weight, but like adding arms to a robot so that you could use something like a Kinect or Leap Motion, and use its head tracking, but then also use the arms the same way you would with your own arms. And there you are, you're flying around, you land, you play with whatever. Especially think of like underwater drones or the underwater kind of oil rigs that always have the problems, you know, they always have to send some kind of a machine down there, or sometimes they have to go down there themselves.
That goes into the direction of like industrial inspection. We hope that it's going to be autonomous, so you won't have pilots, but people might like to actually do it manually. So assuming that it is done manually, you could have this. And then regarding the arms, it's a little bit tough. There's research going on for aerial grasping, and it has some applications. I think everybody saw the video of the Dutch eagle attacking a drone. So
no, I actually haven't seen that.
You haven't seen that
one. We'll post it in the show notes.
It's all over my Facebook timeline.
Yeah, over mine too.
I'm tired. Yeah, it's because you're a friend of mine on Facebook. Yeah.
You said it's an eagle or
yes, they trained an eagle to actually attack a drone. So I mean, right now everyone is super afraid of those 14 minutes long flying things. I mean, yeah, it can fly 14 minutes. Oh my God, we have to catch it. So they're building different concepts. Like in Japan, they have anti-drone drones. And have a net to catch the drones, and apparently they're training, you know, eagles.
I just saw it. I just saw the video. That's fantastic.
There is this nice research that you showed me with this eagle arm being actually built for a drone.
It was again University of Pennsylvania Grass Laboratory. It's I think Vijay Kumar is the name of the professor. But for industrial applications, ground robots are more practical. So you can have a telepresence experience and with arm tracking. That sounds like a very useful thing to do with virtual reality or telepresence.
Mm-hmm. Also, maybe for people who are a little bit more interested in the research part, you also once talked about this institute that does a lot of things.
With drones, there are two in Zurich. It's kind of the mecca for aerial robotics now. There's the Flying Machine Arena, I think .org or .com. Mm-hmm. It's Raffaello De Andrea. And there's another one, a younger professor called Davide Scaramuzza. He has the Robotics and Perception Group at University of Zurich. So the other one was ETH Zurich. This one is University of Zurich. If you like to see cool stuff with drones, visual odometry, SLAM, everything, just go to these guys. Just search Zurich drone and then you'll see all the videos.
We will also put it in the show notes. Yeah. Now let's switch to our VR race drone thingy.
Yeah. So
actually, go on. Before that, you just touched on research. I mean, do you see research kind of fueling your vision as to where you see drones going or what is applicable? Like how much lit review do you do? I mean, actually you're a university student is what, what I take. So I'm guessing you are reading a lot of drone literature. Like, what are you seeing that's happening in the research field that you see will be applicable, let's say like next year by 2 years?
I think
then we'll talk about FPV.
If you want to see what's transferable to VR, I think the new monocular SLAM approaches are the way to go. And I actually talked to Professor Scaramuzza. He explained to me why they went for one camera instead of even a stereo. They're working with these really tiny drones that are like the size of a palm of your hand. In that kind of little space, it doesn't really make sense to have a stereo. They just use the structure from motion, so that just the movement of the camera gives you kind of a stereo. So I think that's the hot trend. One reason is it's a very cheap and lightweight setup. So the computational power, you can get it very cheap. The cameras are normal cameras. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of innovation going there, and it makes a lot of sense also for consumer drones because virtually all of them already have a camera. So there's a company called Skydio from Silicon Valley who is going to become OEM supplier of obstacle avoidance and navigation software for consumer drones. So they don't need any kind of extra sensors. They just use a camera and it's most probably enough for consumer drones. They don't have anything now. There are a couple of industrial drones coming out with obstacle avoidance, but for the consumer ones, they have the processing power, they have the camera. What's missing is really just the software. So I think in that direction, we're going to see a lot of innovation. MIT, they're doing a lot with fixed wing and also multi-rotors research and, you know, maneuvering with just a camera in cluttered environment. Zurich, they're doing stuff. And I think that's the way forward.
Yeah, that's cool. Nice. I'm guessing you've seen the video or the paper on drones making bridges just by using those strings and ropes. I mean, they were very small strings. You saw that, right? That's fascinating, and I'm glad someone is doing research in that field where using multiple drones to work together. Obviously, it was in a room with you have cameras all over. You know, that's how they do their thing. But like you said, by using monocular cameras, you can actually have better positional tracking than you can see this going places. And I'm guessing that's why the Vive also uses only one camera. It's because the head is always moving pretty much when you're wearing a VR headset. So you don't really need two if you can just get away with one. Like, I was always wondering, like, why the hell does the Vive only have one if they're trying to do a chaperone system with showing depth?
Well, my guess is first of all, they're not using an RGB camera, but a depth camera. And there, because you have time of flight, you have not really the need of two cameras. Like the Kinect also uses just one, but virtually you have two because you can like superimpose on the information you have from the time of flight and the camera position where the information is. And also what the Vive maybe indeed has is that because it has head tracking, it kind of can track itself in the space, right?
So it doesn't have external camera tracking.
No, it has a two, but oh yeah, actually it has also external camera tracking. Yeah.
I don't like that. It constrains you to sitting behind your desk or staying in your room.
I mean, so. Yes and no. One important thing about the HTC Vive is the precision. I mean, let's be honest, I have not seen an inside out system that is so amazingly working. And those things are not real cameras, they are laser imagers.
Those aren't inside in or inside out, by the way. Those are outside
in. Exactly, sure.
But
yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
But the camera is not for positional tracking. It's so it shows you what the things around you are, so you don't bump into walls and into cables. Exactly. That's what it's for.
That's really great. I'm gonna get one.
Definitely. I mean, the moment we can get one. Exactly. But the lasers are really amazing because the Oculus, as it seems, uses cameras to track you and also your head movement. But they have actually the trackers on the device. But the laser emitters that they use for reference point are actually on the ceiling, so you can have a very large room that you can run around, apparently.
But honestly, these things don't impress me yet. The day that I see somebody has something like a Google Glass with just one camera, maybe just IMU, plus one camera, if they can do everything robustly, then I'm impressed.
Not yet. It's, at least it works, you know, way better and less clunky than before, right?
Yeah. So drone racing. So we talked a lot about just 360 or surround video and photo on drones. That's very exciting area that's going to see more development as we move forward. But recently, maybe again, you've heard that there is now officially something like Formula One for drones. It's called the Drone Racing League (DRL). And they got a couple of millions financing, and they have custom built drones with their own radios for transmitting the video. That's going to become much more awesome if you add telepresence for the audience to literally sit like a tiny Ant-Man on the drone and look around how like they're crashing into a wall or the other drone, you know, racing together. So that's something that I would love to see, that you don't just have like a crappy analog video being transmitted to your goggle, but you have surround 360 content, and then you as an audience just from wherever in the world, some like Twitch for drones, you see what's going on from the perspective of the drone, and you have freedom to look around.
Can you maybe explain for our audience this digital and analog transmission thingy? So why is this, you know, so important, you know?
Yeah, so I think for drone racing, the most important thing is to have a very low amount of latency. They do these kinds of crazy maneuvers, and they go through tiny holes. So they do need to have near zero latency. And they use visual clues, so they don't need to enjoy the scenery. It's more about the adrenaline in their blood, so they don't need high quality video. The compromise here is that you get, 720 TL, whatever, the old analog standard being transmitted with almost no latency to your goggle. The issue there is that, first of all, you have very low quality. That's why you see all of them have two cameras. They have a GoPro or something that captures full HD or 4K, but that's not real time. And another issue is you have a limit to the number of people who can use the spectrum. It's very limited, the unlicensed spectrum. I think it's something like 3-5, maximum 8 people. You can do some tricks, combine different frequencies to fly more people. But you are probably going to see a switch to digital video, which gives you a very high quality, eventually a zero latency. But that's a little bit expensive now. I think the cheapest commercial solution is from DJI, that they have a live low latency video transmission, but that's not good for racing. It's just good for flying your drone FPV and shooting nice images. Yeah. But there's, I think, an Israeli company who has a so-called zero latency digital Full HD transmission, but their solutions are really expensive. It's a couple of thousand.
Well, in fact, there is an intersection with virtual reality here, because the reason why the Oculus still has a cable is because if you just look at the transmission rates you would need to have to send over the air the raw, you know, 2 or 4K video, and it's something like 6 to 9 gigabit.
Wow, there you go.
Yeah, and it's really,
I hadn't thought about. I was looking for some kind of wireless display transmitter for my laptop, and I think it's getting better, but there's nothing that works like HDMI. You can't play FPS games on your laptop with wireless display. So as long as this is not fixed, you're not gonna have cable-less. VR experience. So that you're right. There's synergies here.
Yeah.
But for drones, you need to also think about the distances and occlusions, and they go through buildings. There's concrete. There's wood. Everything.
Definitely.
You have multiple kind of systems
like working together. One for it's close range. One it's when it's very far. Some kind of hybrid smart systems. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah, that's definitely very cool. We want HMDs to be completely wireless, and that's probably one of the biggest breaking of immersion is when you're stepping over the HTC Vive's like cable, and when you're standing up and you're flinging around.
That happened to me so many
times. Really awkward. That's why I love Samsung solution.
Yes.
So you just put it on your
Gear face. VR. Yeah.
That's why we all love it, yeah.
It's great.
It doesn't have the capability of a computer for rendering.
For just content, like just watching 4K, fine, 360 footage, that's fine. And exactly. I kind of have the feeling that at least for drones, that's going to be a big thing. That you, as soon as you have multiple ways to consume 360 content, you're going to see many drone studios starting shooting 360 content all around the world.
Yeah, I think they will really support each other, and this will be, nice collaboration between the VR guys and the drone guys, because both of their market is kind of, supporting each other.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing.
So I think we could wrap it up here for the drone part, but, I'm open to having some kind of brainstorming about what's going to happen in future, what you guys imagine seeing drones and AR and virtual reality happening, together maybe in 5-10 years.
I have 2 or 3 crazy ideas, but maybe first Azad can share his thoughts.
The one thing that's
kind of been going through my mind with drones is like you said, the interaction method with it. Currently we've been using just normal flight sticks and just things that we've taken from RC helicopters and planes and whatnot and retrofitted them here. The one thing we don't, and let's say we want to use motion controllers or whatnot, but like your reach only goes out to, your arm's length, and that's kind of as far as it goes. I've always been thinking about eye trackers and how we can use that better. And actually one application I was thinking is by using eye trackers, you can actually place markers far, far ahead, kind of like the augmented reality drone that you were talking about. That is kind of the biggest problem with interaction is that you don't actually have reach that is that far. So by using your eyes, and you need a system that's smart enough to understand, when you're inputting something versus when you're looking at something. I know there's some advancements happening there. You know, what do you think of something like that, where you just look at somewhere, you place a marker there, and you see your drone go by there while you're doing other tasks?
You just publicly announced the topic of my thesis.
Oh, shit. No way.
Okay.
Wow. What? So, that's, yeah, tell us more about that. That sounds awesome.
I mean, this is relevant for me because before starting my company, I was doing input modality research for drones. And we had poor students here for their first time mostly. And we gave them different ways to control drones. It was touch. It was the like real sense kind of thing, and normal sticks and also joystick. I couldn't do back then was to actually use eye tracking or gaze tracking or head tracking. In fact, head tracking is going to be enough for the beginning. I mean, if you want to simplify it a little bit, you don't really need to have your eyes at such a long distance. So you just move your head and then that could be enough.
How can you explain that? I mean, how would you?
So imagine you have like a vector going out of your Microsoft HoloLens head-mounted goggle thingy,
and just a static straight perpendicular.
Yeah, like kind of vector. Like a virtual vector going out of your head,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you can look around. In fact, it's better to not use your gaze. You need it for something else. It might be in search and rescue scenario where you need to have saccades. You need to look at things in front of you. But at the same time, there's that, you know, poor boy or lady somewhere, you know, far that you can't reach yourself. So you just fixate on that point, and then you have some options. You select an option, let's say rescue, deliver, emergency kit or something. And then what you need to have is, first of all, to transform your reference with the drone. So you need to know exactly where you are staying, so the things that you need, where I am looking at, and where is the drone exactly. So if you have all these things, and then so the drone can find out exactly where it should go. What is missing here, and as you said, is you need to have some kind of landmark detection or object detection. It could be based on just RGB data, or it could be something like a combination of your absolute position with your heading, and then you have the ground plane, you get it out. So you don't necessarily need object recognition. There are different ways to do it. And then the drone has its own sensor suite, so it can do obstacle avoidance, navigate itself, go to the point, and deliver something. I think this is going to be very useful, especially for inspection, industrial inspection, for search and rescue, and eventually also for the battlefield. The last one, probably you've seen it from Call of Duty already. Mm-hmm. It's quite exciting to have also new ways of interacting with drones, not just the drone itself becoming intelligent. That's probably going to be the only way we interact with them, that we don't interact at all. I call this ZUI, zero user interface, because the drone is so smart, it doesn't need to get anything from you.
But I like a ZUI. That's a great term, actually.
Yeah, but hashtag ZUI. And people on Twitter, follow us, hashtag ZUI.
Exactly.
But in short term, you are going to need to interact with drones, and you need to give them high level commands instead of just using a control stick, move left, right, up, down. That's really old school. So I hope to see this happening, and I hope I can be a part of it.
I think that's a great point, and people often forget this, even with self-driving cars and whatnot. It's that, okay, they're becoming autonomous, yes, but that doesn't mean it's completely, you don't have to input with it at all. It just does everything. I mean, it still needs, like you said, high-level commands. If you want to do something, if you want to change something, if you want to even see where it's going and what it's doing, like, there is going to be some still a little bit of an interface between you and the system, because you want that confidence of the user of to know what the system itself is doing. Otherwise, it's a scary technology, you know. Otherwise, then you have Terminator like drones and whatnot. Like you don't want to scare someone.
You don't want autistic drones that have no way of communicating with humans.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
And the more they become autonomous, the more you still have your way of controlling things. Like that's no one's taking that part away. They're just taking away the silly, hard and repetitive motion stuff that takes to fly a drone, let's say.
Yeah. It's in fact a completely new paradigm in human computer interaction or human robot interaction, that things have so much autonomy in near future that a lot of the previous interfaces are going to be redundant. So you don't need 95% of all the buttons and displays and everything that you have now. Voice is one way. It's a classic method of interacting with all kinds of creatures, including robots.
Hey Siri.
Yeah, hey Siri. Okay, Google.
No. Don't turn my phone off.
Yeah. But you also have a lot of scenarios where you're in real world and you could use the environment itself as your interface.
Absolutely. I had another question, but I forgot it. So, Peter, you go with yours.
Well, when we were preparing this episode with Nima, I was having this crazy idea where, imagine, like, this is a stupid example, but let's say you have paintball, right? A lot of people are running around and there are some huge air pillars, they are behind shooting at each other. And let's say there are 300 drones around them mapping this whole place completely in life. And you could have, some kind of VR representation or augmented reality representation of it. Because if we think about the HoloLens, it has two Kinects inbuilt, so it can track the room. But let's say if you start to run around an unknown environment, it will have some certain problems, is it now a wall? Is it a building? Is it glass? It needs kind of to understand it. And if you have, let's say, a huge swarm of those drones, flying around, mapping everything, then you could have some very interesting augmented reality happening, it always depends on how long can the drone fly and things, but
I don't know if we need drones for that. Couldn't you just put those cameras on the stick?
I said the same thing,
right?
But
right,
he has a point. If you're in the middle
unknown
of a jungle,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If you're in a completely unknown environment,
exactly,
it's never been scanned before. There is a middle ground between no drone and 300 drone. You could have, let's say, 5 drones flying around, scanning the environment, and then repeating this every 10 minutes. So if there is a non-static object which is moved,
and
you refresh it in your, let's say, virtual battlefield map for your
paintball guys. Well, let's say there is a secret, agent who is, masked as a stone, and you map the whole, forest every 10 minutes, and you see, the stone is slowly crawling towards me. That's suspicious.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, we're getting to the point of, literally tracking huge amounts of space around us, right? Like that's
huge.
Yes.
Not huge, as Bernie Sanders says, huge amounts.
Huge.
Yes.
Wait, you guys know who Bernie Sanders is?
Hey guy, everybody go vote for Bernie Sanders, please. As an Iranian, for world peace, I endorse Bernie Sanders here.
I would like to troll and say go vote for Donald Trump, but I will be careful with that.
You know what? I'm going for Michael Bloomberg.
Watch your podcast,
no,
if you say.
We are very, independent, and we are not particularly for one party here. We are, do whatever you think is right. Just think about the consequences. But
by the way, if you're interested in robotics, AI, power, and politics, follow me on Twitter. It's inside Nima inside Nima.
We will plug you in the show notes.
That sounds a little.
it's inside of Nima. It's inside of the upper hemisphere of Nima.
Is it Caspian Robotics? Is the name of your? Oh no, that's just Caspian Robotics Twitter. Because I typed in inside Nima and Caspian Robotics came up.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll put it in the notes.
Yes,
yeah,
definitely.
Put it in show notes.
Okay, guys, let's end it slowly. And
wait, no? What? No, hold up. We're having a wonderful conversation. I have one or two more things I want to ask you about. If we'll keep this short, under an hour. Anyway, what about photogrammetry? Is something I've been really getting into. I don't know if you've done that much, but like the ability to map out, you know, everything from an object to your room to an actual city is huge. And people
are
huge
market.
It's very huge. And I mean, I even saw, I've seen companies doing kind of like VR tourism now where they do a photogrammetry scan of, let's say, a German castle. Like it's a cool company called realities.io. They're in the Boost VC incubator right now. And they're mapping out castles and then basically placing you as a person there. Like, where do you see this going? Because photogrammetry really did start with drones, I believe, for GIS kind of applications. And now people are like, oh, we can use this for 3D modeling. We can use this for whatever. I mean, have you had much experience with it? And do you use it for your company?
It's we had a spin-off product with Velodyne for this, not for photogrammetry, but for mapping with LiDARs. You're serving the same customers at the end. The difference is with point clouds that come out of LiDARs, laser scanners, you just get depth data with, you know, a couple of more things that you can extract, like
reflectance,
no texture,
no color.
Photogrammetry, you almost always have some texture. You could have different types of cameras, but it's a large chunk of the whole drone market now that people use drones with GPS, just a camera to map everywhere. Like construction sites, they could use the data on a daily basis to have a new refreshed map of the whole environment. I think a very good company there that I like is Drone Deploy. They have a fully cloud-based solution. There's Pix4D, it's a Swiss company. They're, I think, the oldest company and maybe the best. So that is very commercialized. I haven't personally seen much in entertainment. So to have like virtual tourism, that's a very cool idea. One issue that I have always felt you have with photogrammetry is the quality after you stitch the photos when you don't have any LiDAR and you just have maybe IMU and just the camera. It's never perfect. It's more crappy than perfect. So it's not consumable. Maybe it's going to get better if they combine something like RealSense depth sensors with texture. It might be actually usable, but in short term, just 360 video is going to be huge. And then later, virtual tourism. So literally having the ability to pilot the drone. That's the next thing, really.
Nice.
Another thing, I don't know how the German kind of airspace is handled, but the FAA here is, actually, I think it's much needed regulations. As big of a fan I am of, like, you know, freedom and everything, but like you're still going to have idiots doing a lot of idiotic things, like flying them into, you know, not the World Trade Center to the Empire State Building, to to the White House, whatever. So they're I think what they're doing is the numbers might be off that I'm saying here, but they're essentially creating this zone in between 100 feet to like 200 feet where you can fly your camera drone, you can fly your Amazon drone, delivery drone, everything, and then from, I think, 300 to 400 feet is no fly zone. And then from 400 feet and up is manned aerial aircraft. So, like, basically, we're going to have different layers of flying things. I mean, what do you think about that? And how is Europe handling it? Or how is Germany doing that as well?
I think until one year ago or even less, like half a year ago, Europe was ahead of US regarding the regulation. But there's been so much lobbying and VC money going into drone startups in the Bay Area that they've pushed FAA to their limits. Like they're almost privatizing FAA, I think. They're doing a whole lot of projects with different companies like Google, Amazon, Flirtree. Everybody's trying to take a piece of it. It definitely makes sense to have virtual corridors in the air, so even before taking off where I can and I cannot fly.
And augmented reality would be perfect for that, to actually see that 3D space kind of painted for you to kind of follow.
If you have a human being. So I'm strongly opposed to having humans in the loop for drones, because you can't sit inside the drone. So the quality of data and piloting, it's never going to be as good as like a helicopter pilot. You're not inside it. You don't have the complete presence. It makes sense to have a segregated airspace. And Amazon, I think, is really pushing for that. In Europe, the issue is you have different countries with their own regulation. There was a large meeting in Riga a couple of months ago or half a year ago that they laid out the plan for unified European regulations for UAS or drones, basically. But it's, as far as I've seen, it doesn't look very good. So it's worse than what we have now in Germany. But at least it's going to be unified. What I think is going to be implemented is a limit to the weight, total weight of the drone, including cargo. So that's going to be the main factor dividing hobby drones and then commercial drones.
Why would they do that? I mean, what's the thought process behind it? So you don't fly people or bombs, or like what's the...
Limiting the risk. If you have a drone with 50 kilogram payload and it falls down even from 10 meters on a car, it's a different scenario than when you have a limit of 2 kilogram or 4 kilogram. So
it's just physics at some point.
There is an issue here with the difference between the force and the weight. That I think French people are more sophisticated there, so they also take into account the speed at the impact, and like they put some limits there. But so I think there's going to be a higher limit for commercial applications, very strict, some like 20-25 kilogram. That's the max that you can go, and if you're above 4 or 5 kilogram. You usually do not get a permanent permission of flight. So you need to ask every time. And that was really bad for our business, because if you have an autonomous drone and you need 2 weeks to ask for permission to be autonomous, it's not a business anymore. So at least for the next 3 to 5 years in Europe, you're not going to see anything that allows complete autonomy beyond line of sight. So this BLOS or VLOS, these two terms, they're very important. It's if you can fly beyond your visual line of sight, like it's usually between 100 to 500 meters, depending on weather condition. So these are a couple of factors that need to be taken into account, but people are doing business like manually flying drones for weddings and inspection. Drone delivery is not yet a reality anywhere. Yesterday, Iran had the first drone delivery program announced. DigiKala, which is our kind of Amazon, it's a clone of Amazon. They announced a competition.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to support one or two teams in Iran to participate.
Absolutely,
in
man.
This.
And send us a link. I'd love to take a look, actually.
Yeah, I'll send you the link. I think it's in Persian, but I hope you there
Google
will be
translate.
Something in English. Yeah, I think all the larger companies are also getting into drones, like Airbus. I know personally they want to have a drone delivery program.
So that's okay. That's happening. I'm happy to hear that. It's not
well. Let's say there are some cases where it's like really super interesting. Let's say someone needs a heart transplant, right? Or you need suddenly blood in terms of an emergency. I mean, despite costs and everything, you really need to deliver this, fragile thing very fast. And there, I mean, it makes sense to make it, you know, even super expensive because it saves lives and, you know, it's still cheaper than a helicopter flying it.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, getting my cigarettes in the night or a pack of condoms, I'm still suspicious.
That's an idea. We have to do a startup.
You know. Yeah, well,
there you go.
On-demand.
Magic.
Yeah. Uber for condoms.
Yeah.
Right. You know, there are actually those delivery services out now that you just use. You actually just text them. You know, one is called, like, Get Magic, and you just text them.
Yeah,
like,
Silicon Valley kind of convenience that you have there.
Super strange. You have underwear delivery in U.S.
Yeah, you just text the guy anything. They do everything for you. Like
they do. even Facebook even Facebook M Messenger, which is their AI thing. Yeah. That's what it can do as well. You just type things to it. But I think they're using a lot of like human operators behind it.
Yes, a lot.
It's like, what the hell? Like,
that doesn't matter.
What's the point?
If it makes financial sense for them to hire people, why not?
Send my mother flowers. Well, in a busy world, you know, you're in Silicon Valley, you're working 24/7, you know, you barely have time to eat. Well, okay, you also outsource things like sending flowers to your lover. Well, I don't know. Yeah. Makes sense.
For closing thoughts, I'm sure you saw this, Nima, at CES, is that there's this Chinese company that's creating this really big drone, right? And that it's, I believe, completely autonomous as well. But like, it's a person that actually can sit inside and fly. And it's funny because, like, I was thinking, you know, 50, 60 years ago, we were thinking of flying cars as the way to go. But turns out that's like, we're taking a really big thing and trying to make it fly. And then now we're starting off with very small things and making that little bit bigger and bigger, bigger, so that we can sit in and fly. So the approach actually is really the difference that's really making it true, because there's
people to do this were in fact from Germany, and they were quite successful with a crowdfunding, equity-based crowdfunding campaign. But as always, I think we're going to have another podcast about the glass ceiling and the situation with funding in Europe. I hope I can add something there, but nobody knows about these poor guys. It's called Evolo. The drone is called Evolo. They're now, I think, a part of Ascending Technologies, which was bought by Intel. So they tried to do it first with more rotors. But what I personally don't completely get is why we don't have freaking electric helicopters. I mean, helicopters are safer at the end.
Yes.
They have this ability to auto rotate and then, you know, not just fall down into a stall like a stone. But you know, it's all, you know, innovation, and it's cool. So I think it's going to be practical maybe in 2-3 years for tourism. Instead of cable cars, you could have a whole bunch of these drones that are semi-autonomous, and then they fly you around a mountain or something.
Well, I mean, regards, you know, how you will move in the future, in a certain point, I mean, you need to have a huge battery, and even this thing from CES is actually, you know, capable of, I think, 8 kilometers or something to fly. It's really not much. So,
no.
I mean,
helicopters are way more efficient.
Are way more efficient. However, you still need a huge battery that is, you know, very dangerous to have with you.
With the same amount of battery, a helicopter flies longer.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just physics. You have one large surface instead of a lot of tiny things. Even with this size of drone, I mean, the audience doesn't see the picture, but it's Ehang 184. It has, I think the props look like being some like 30 inches maybe or 20 something. These types of motors are much more efficient than tiny rotors of, I don't know, 10, 12 inch. So it just scales up, and that's why helicopters are more efficient at the end.
Well, I mean, Tesla just announced some rumors. Yeah, we will have to go.
Yeah, Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. No, I don't have to go. I just meant for the, you know.
No, don't worry about the time. We are
a podcast. Okay. As long as we are not getting, you know, stones to us delivered by people.
No, it's fine.
Elon Musk actually, you know, he builds this Tesla stuff, and there are rumors that the next Tesla will, compared to the ones they have now, which cost $120,000, I think.
Upwards of
exactly.
Yeah.
The new one will cost 35.
Mm-hmm. And that's before government rebates.
And 35 is really cheap.
But this has nothing to do with drones. I thought you wanted to talk about the vertical airplane.
It has, because battery.
But I heard Elon Musk talked about a vertical takeoff electric airplane.
This guy is crazy.
I mean, he is. Iron Man is nothing compared to him.
Listen, if he's making capsules that will come back from space and then land themselves down, then I'm guessing he can make something that can also shoot itself up and then land as well. Like, that they're just making very, very big drones and very expensive
drones. But here, the difference is their customer is NASA. NASA has a lot of money to waste. And even being 10x cheaper.
Not really.
It's not wasting.
I mean, even having 10x cheaper prices compared to what they paid earlier is a still huge amount.
No.
But the,
it's not. It's just $1,000 per kilogram. It's very cheap.
Yeah, it's much cheaper than what NASA has been doing.
What I meant was compare this target market with commercial airliners. And it's a completely non-profitable industry. Commercial airlines, no, they're one of the worst. I think just the annual profit of Google alone was more than the combined profit of the whole U.S. commercial airliners.
Sure, but I mean, so bringing things to space is very lucrative. I mean, you have those days satellites that are due to, you know, development of technology. You call them, I think, nano or micro satellites. They're like you have like very small cubes, and I mean, if, you know, it cost you $1,000 to bring this thing up to the space, well, you can shoot tens of them, you know, just do something.
Yeah, but I mean about a vertical electric airplane that probably is going to sell it to the same audience of rich Silicon Valley dudes first. Yeah, and then we'll see where it goes. But,
You know, in that field, it's not an electric airplane, but I've seen this. I wish I can remember what it was called, but basically it's a very small plane, $150,000 only, and it starts in water, and you can just fly, you know, just running around in water, and then it can take off, and you can fly up to, I think, about 100 or 150 feet.
That one was great. Peter and I are going to save our money to buy one.
Yes, definitely.
Honestly, it looked amazing. Like, you can just have the window open. You can stick your head outside as you're flying around like a bird.
It had this feature that didn't let you flip the airplane. It had some kind of safety feature.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah, it was beginner friendly. Let's buy one.
Definitely, yeah.
The audience, if all of you donate 10,000 euro, we can buy one of these things, and then we'll let you take a photo with it.
Okay, Nima, for closing, I want to ask you a short, quick thing. Where do you see the industry being in the next 5 years? Just very simple. I think 10 years is a little hard to predict, although you can put out your predictions for that as well. But next 5 years, I think, is a concrete amount of time that you probably have some good understanding of where it's going.
I assume you meant the drone industry, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's your industry, so.
I think from what I've seen already from 2018-19, hopefully we're going to have more autonomy-friendly regulations in Europe, at least. That's what I know. So when they say 2018-19, you should count on 2022. It's just the Garmin stuff. So it fits into the next 5 years that you asked. I think what's going to happen is that you're going to see not door-to-door delivery drones, but you're going to see emergency and long-distance delivery with drones. They are going to be, I think, ubiquitous in Africa because they don't have the infrastructure that we have in Germany. So things that don't make commercial sense here in Europe might eventually make sense in Africa and other developing countries.
Definitely.
I think the augmented reality industry is going to go even further than what we can imagine. You just look at the funding numbers for Magic Leap.
Oh, gosh. Another unicorn.
Who knows what they're cooking up? They're already a unicorn. So I think the robotics industry could also benefit from that. You don't have these kinds of unicorns in the drone space. It's just there's just too much hype.
I think DJI is right now. They're over a billion, I believe.
Yeah, but it's just a consumer product mostly. So it's going to be really exciting to see more autonomy coming from the AR industry and research to the drone space, and then the other way around. So I think it's going to be a very nice symbiosis from, you know, between these two industries.
Do you see, will we have drones that when you go on a family vacation, you just throw up there and it starts circling around you for like an hour or two as you're sitting at the beach with your family? Is that something that we can all have in the next 5 years?
Depends on the battery.
I think commercially, if you look at the factories that are being built for that time scope, they do not seem to have a dramatically different technology than what we have now. Maybe it's going to be 20%, 30% more efficient and give you longer endurance, but not like, you know, infinite. One hour is almost infinite for these tiny drones. And you don't really need 1 hour. If you have half an hour with some kind of smart combination of vertical takeoff, convertibles, and then fixed wing, that's already enough. You just need peace of mind that your drone is not going to fall into the ocean.
Let's quote Bill Gates 20 years ago, who in their mind would need 2 megabytes of RAM?
Two megabytes of RAM.
Yeah, you said it once.
I already regret that quote. My laptop has 8 gigabytes. Yeah, so you know.
Who in their mind needs 1 hour of flight with a drone? Yeah, no. The more is better, but yeah. Right.
Okay, you compared me to Bill Gates. Thank you.
Okay. Let's. Yeah. Okay, guys.
We are through, well, right? Maybe a short announcement before we thank our lovely guest Nima. Mm-hmm. Actually, no. Yeah, because he might join us on a secret, suspicious, and amazing, soon to be possibly happening podcast that we are planning behind the curtains. I mean, tune in. Maybe it's the next one or the next one or. Maybe the next one will be the next.
It's going to be more
maybe in a
business oriented.
Exactly, it will be very business oriented, but business oriented completely on VR. Yeah. So drones won't be such a hot topic there anymore. That's why we actually did this topic with drones. So Nima is a little bit, you know, more patient next time we have him here with another special guest that we will announce next time.
Yeah.
So he can, you know, focus more on the investment and other things. Well.
Cool.
Then, as again, we mentioned it many times, please retweet us, follow us. We have Research VR Cast on Twitter. Write us emails, comment our stuff if you like it, if you don't like it, especially too. You know, spread the word that we are here. If you have any suggestions, go on.
Yeah, and just leave the podcast playing when you take shower, even if you don't listen to it. Just, it's good for having statistics.
Well, just download it. That's enough. You can rate us on iTunes. If you have an iTunes account, go now instantly to iTunes and give us ratings.
And more importantly, just let us know what you think. I mean, if we're doing it right, if we're doing it wrong, what would you like to see more of? I mean, we kind of took a little sidestep from VR today with drones, but I mean, obviously the overlap is apparent, but. So yeah, let us know. This has been a really fun thing for us to do. As you can probably tell, we are all sounding better this episode. We all got new microphones and headphones and podcasting rigs. Yeah, we feel quite professional now. So it's a learning process, and I'm glad you guys are here to join us on the way for on the way to stardom. Yes, we're going to be celebrities very, very soon.
Sure. Definitely.
In the podcast.
So next Bill Gates, Nima Ashkari, and Azad Balabanian, the next, you know, UI guru.
We have the names for it, so the unpronounceable names. That's okay. What will make us stars.
Well, thank you very much for joining, Nima.
Yeah, it was fun.
Okay. Goodbye.
All right. Bye. Ciao.